Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
America, and welcome to First Things First. I'm Jenna Wolf. That is the Hall of Famer Chris Carter. He's in a good mood. This is Nick Wright. He's in a good mood. We are in a good mood.
Jenny yelled at me this morning, America.
I did.
I didn't even do nothing.
I did. I was a little
Jenna,
bit off.
Jenna just snapped at
what
me.
Did I do 10 minutes after I yelled at you?
She walked in and said, and you ever talk like that again, Nick Wright?
No.
You'll
I
be
said,
gone.
I said, I apologized. Said, I love you, Nick Wright. I always will. We got a big Wednesday show for you today. Some surprising news about Cam Newton. We've got a LeBron James injury update for you. That also may surprise you, but we're going to start with the Kansas City Chiefs. In four short days, Patrick Mahomes will play in the most important game of his career, AFC Championship game at home against Tom Brady and the New England Patriots. Shouldn't come as that big of a surprise. Mahomes threw for over 5,000 yards and 50 touchdowns this season for the Chiefs. Bill Belichick had high praise for this Chiefs offense, said there's not a better, quote, fast-starting team than the Chiefs. All right, CeCe, if the Patriots are going to do it, how will they attack this offense? How do they start slowing down this Chiefs offense?
Well, I love Belichick's press conferences when he does give us a little bit as far as what he's looking at. And typically, you know he will not compliment someone unless he overemphasizes it. So typically every week he doesn't reach for a player or an aspect of what the opposition is doing. But you see this week and them starting fast. He understands that. Because even in the game they faced them this year, even though they were able to slow them down in the red zone, man, they started fast. They were up and down the field. I mean, 50-yard drive, 60-yard drive. They were up and down the field three times in a row. So, yes, he's right about that. And also, if we had an Olympic relay team, you probably get three or four guys off of Kansas City. So, actually, Kelce is one of the faster tight ends that we have in the league. Tyreek Hill is in a class by himself as far as wide receivers, elite wide receivers, and the type of speed that he brings to the table. Sammy Watkins being out there on the field. So, speed, how do you negate that speed? By penetration into the line of scrimmage. That's how you take them away from the running game on first and second down. How many tackles for losses? But we've always known with the Bill Belichick coach team, when they face these powerful offenses, when they face a lot of speed. How do they combat that? They combat it at the line of the scrimmage. That's why they changed the bumping rules down the field after them mauling the Indianapolis Colts a number of times in the playoffs. It's like, this is the Patriot rule. You can't tackle guys at the line of scrimmage. In playoff football, Nick pointed out last week, it might be an advantage to Kansas City that the playoff referees, they're an all-star crew, and they let you play a little more physical. So in the secondary, the Patriots understand this, and they like to clamp down to be able to negate that speed and get to the quarterback by making you run a long route to be able to get to your pattern. So that's what the Patriots are going to do. That's what they've done through the years. Travis Kelce will be bumped by a linebacker, defensive lineman of some type of sort. He is not going to get a free release down the field. And Tyreek Hill, they will have a heavy concentration. I believe 80% of the game they will double team him or have two defenders in his area, Nick.
So listen, I said it last week, the Chiefs are the best front running team that I have seen. That if this team jumps out to a lead, that's when Pat Mahomes stops taking chances. They are more methodical and they still have the ability, even when being methodical, to have a 60-yard touchdown at any given moment. So it is important that the Patriots don't let the Chiefs in this home environment get off to a fast start. I think that means tilting all their coverage, almost slanting the field towards Tyreek Hill to seize point about 80% of the time being double teamed, and giving the Chiefs looks that are daring them to run the football. I think they are going to present defensive fronts that say, you've got to run it. Like, what are you thinking? Like, the opposite of what we talked about the Cowboys were facing early in the year.
Sure.
When the Cowboys were facing defenses, like, you, how can you not pass here? There's nine guys in the box. You got two guys in single coverage. Mm-hmm. I think the Patriots are going to say to the Chiefs, if you can drive 12 play drives without committing a holding penalty, without having one dropped pass, without having one play that gets you off schedule,
go for it.
You know what? We'll tip our cap to you. I think they are going to try to prevent the league's best quick strike offense, the team that has more touchdown drives of five plays or fewer than anyone in football, from scoring that way, and see how the game looks in the second half.
Right. We know the NFL has changed, especially as far as the emphasis on offense, the amount of points being scored, the amount of yards being accumulated throughout the games this year for the first time ever. The four highest scoring teams that we have in the NFL, they are our final four teams. So you have to realize that I believe Bill Belichick will go back to his mentor and Bill Parcells, and he'll try to slow this game down. They'll play the game a lot like the Giants did in the 80s and the 90s, where they will have at least 40 run attempts. They will throw the ball short. Their special teams, they'll try to pin them down. They'll play the field position game. And Tom Brady and that offense with Josh McDaniels, they're going to be super, super aggressive. Because when you have the type of team that Kansas City has offensively, you have to try to make them go the distance, as Nick say, to try to make them be methodical. And also that you can believe, and I believe this is the key to the game, can the Patriots steal an extra two possessions? That's how you. So I believe they'll take more chances on defense trying to force turnovers because they realize that's one way in being able to slow down an offense like the Kansas City Chiefs.
If you're going to slow down or stop Tyreek Hill by keeping him in check before he gets downfield, what's the solution to Patrick Mahomes? Is it going to be more blitzing? Is it going to be show him things he doesn't know? Because that's where the speed is going to start.
So here's the thing. The folks at Next Gen Stats over the last 3 weeks have been releasing basically all of their end-of-year rankings, rolling out to the left, rolling out to the right, against the blitz, against only three rushers. And the one consistent thing is Pat Mahomes is first, second, third in every scenario. Like, that is that when you have the season he had, there is no, well, he's bad against the blitz. No, he's top three against the blitz. Well, he's bad when you drop seven. No, he's top three when you drop seven. So there isn't a solution that we haven't seen one yet for Patrick Mahomes in that regard. What I think they will do is as they always do, try to get pressure up the middle and try to make him see on the first four drives four different types of coverages. Make him see things that on the first drive, they're playing bump and run or press man. Mm-hmm. And then second drive out of nowhere, they drop into a soft zone. Like, just continually try to confuse him. And when you mentioned the Giants and Parcells in the ADC, the game that I would go back to and the team that a Belichick coach defense went up against, an all-time offense, the Super Bowl against those Buffalo Bills, that nobody could slow down that Bills offense all year long. And in the 30 for 30, they talk about it, how the game plan Belichick came up with might have been not just up to that point of his career, but up until his first Super Bowl with the Patriots, the crowning achievement of his football life. The 2 weeks preparing that Giants defense to go up against that Bills offense, this offense is of that caliber, if not higher, and I think it's going to take a similar game plan to slow it down.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the matchup. There's going to be a lot of chess match between Andy Reid going back and forth, but I just believe that the New England Patriots are going to be far more aggressive. In these types of games, you see they're more aggressive in their coverages. What do they do with Tyreek Hill when he's in the slot? Because it's easy to say, I can bump the tight end. It's easy to say in the olden days, maul the wide receivers and play two-man, play combination coverages. But he has the type of speed that if you try to bracket, if I'm in the slot, Nick's a corner, Jenna, you're a safety, and you guys say, if I go inside, you're going to guard me. What you're going to do is be leveraging inside, but you're also going to be settling. And outside, you got all the outside breaking, and you got all the deep routes. So you're going to be leveraging, too, around 12 to 15 yards. What you don't account for in the double team is the speed. If I just split you guys And that's what Tyreek Hill, because they've moved him in the slot, because he's developed these other aspects of his game, that's why, Nick, you potentially think he's the most dangerous player on the field who's a non-quarterback.
Well, no question about it. And we're going to talk about Tyreek Hill every time we talk about this game from an offensive perspective, because I can't sit here and say Tyreek Hill is the best receiver in football. I can sit here and say there is not a single receiver in the league the Chiefs would trade Tyreek Hill for. Given what their offense is and who their quarterback is, he is the perfect complement to a strong-arm quarterback who can throw the ball anywhere. His once-in-a-lifetime speed is the perfect complement to pair with Patrick Mahomes, which is why that is the biggest reason that this Chiefs team is the third-highest-scoring offense in football. They have great quarterback, great tight end, great play caller. But the Mahomes-Tyreek Hill connection has opened everything up for everyone else.
And we're expecting there to be more punts in this game. It's going to be very cold. It's going to be frigid. We don't expect them to go up and down the field like they did in the first meeting where the Patriots didn't punt at all. So in doing that, let's not forget, the most feared guy to return punts in the NFL, Tyreek Hill. He's still doing it full time. So not only is he a number one receiver, not only is he elite, and I understand what you're saying as far as no receiver, Julio Jones, A.B., your guy, Odell.
Those guys might all be better than him, but
as a wide receiver, but what he does for Kansas City in that game, in the offense that they run, and his special teams, that's why you say that can't be replaced.
Maybe not the best. Is he the fastest receiver in the NFL?
He's the fastest player in the NFL.
Is Jenna going to work out today?
I was just coming up. I probably couldn't beat him in a race. Could the Panthers shut down Cam Newton for the entire next season? Their owner thinks they might. That's next on First Things First.
There's something about auctions that makes shopping so much more fun. For sports fans, it probably has something to do with the competition and suspense that auctions provide. But who wants to spend time researching where their nearest auction house is and then make the trek all the way there? I definitely don't. And that's why I love Pristine Auction, an online sports auction house where you can buy and sell sports memorabilia from the comfort of your own home. Pristine Auction runs tons of different auction formats, including multiple weekly auctions, a premium monthly auction, as well as daily and 10-minute auctions. They guarantee the authenticity of all of their items, and everything you purchase comes from only the most trusted sources. And the best part? It's so affordable. I just saw an autographed Ricky Stenhouse Jr. photo that sold for only $6. Go check out Pristine Auction now. You'll be hooked. It's free to register, free to bid, and you only pay for the items you win. That's pristineauction.com. And when you register, be sure to select First Things First podcast from the drop-down menu in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Let them know we sent you. Make sure you select First Things First podcast from the drop-down menu when you go to pristineauction.com.
All right, moving on. Some surprising news out of Carolina yesterday. It seems Cam Newton's shoulder injury is worse than originally suspected. Cam was hampered by it most of the year. Panthers owner David Tepper said the team might take drastic steps for his long-term future. Tepper isn't ruling out Newton missing the entire season, saying we've got to make sure we have our options open in all ways possible, just in case. A lot of different interpretations here, but Nick, what is your reaction to this?
Well, I don't want to overreact. I don't think Dave Tepper was saying they expect Cam to miss the season, and I don't think anyone should expect Cam to miss the season. He was kind of speaking hypothetically, and then right after he opened the door to Cam missing the season, he tried to close it a little bit. And like, well, we're not saying that's going to happen, but the reality is Cam Newton had shoulder surgery last year. He then injured his shoulder in week 6 this year and then got it really injured on that TJ Watt hit and was never the same after that.
Mm-hmm.
They need to learn from the mistakes made in the Andrew Luck recovery. And whatever the most cautious process is, whatever the steps need to be, not skipping steps, not rushing back. And if that means Cam isn't ready for training camp, then Cam's not ready for training camp. Like, Cam Newton, we know that he has the ability to be one of the very best quarterbacks in this league. We also know that, as we saw last year, that if his play falls off, the team falls apart.
And that's what happened last season.
That is 100% what happened last season. And so Cam took a lot of criticism late in the year, but we now know he was dealing with a significant shoulder injury. I don't think they have a contingency plan. Like, if Cam is to miss significant time, Taylor Heineke's not the answer. You're not in a position where you're going to spend a premium draft pick on a quarterback because you have Cam. You're not going to spend big free agent money on a quarterback because you have Cam. So they're kind of in a holding pattern, but I would execute extreme caution because he still has another 6 to 8 years left in his career after this coming season.
I think Andrew Luck's a good example. I think him and Andrew Luck both 29 years old. So it's relatively, you can compare the two. He's a few steps before Andrew got into the situation that he ended up at because there might have been a misdiagnosis with Cam. He had a procedure done this last year. And he was rehabbed and ready to go. But typically, do you have some type of setback? And he had a couple big hits. The one the from Watt was significant. That did change his season. I'm sure it changed his body. And then covering the league this year and spending some time with Cam doing one of his games, I know that he spent an extensive amount of time with the training staff and the medical staff. It got to a point that Cam appreciated them so much that every Thursday night, Cam was having a meal catered to the medical staff because they were spending so much time on him and on his body. He did that out of appreciation. A lot of people didn't know that. So I knew that there was a problem long before that. I don't believe that there is a solution moving forward. I do believe that Ron Turner, the quarterback coach, North Turner, the offensive coordinator, and their relationship with Tyler Heinicke going back to their days in Minnesota, they do have a lot of time invested in him. He's a little undersized, started 4 years of college, so he does have some experience at the pro game. He does have a big-time arm, even though he doesn't look like it. So I don't look for them to potentially look for someone to replace Cam for the season. I think they'll be very cautious in going about it, but you have to realize too that Cam has one of those big contracts. So when you have one of those big quarterback contracts, you're limited as far as what you can do. You can't go out and get someone like Nick Foles, what they can do in Philadelphia, because Carson Wentz is still on his first deal.
If we learn that he will indeed miss the season, does that change what you guys think their options are? If we learn that, you know what, they're going to sit him out for the whole season, then you don't want to have the season as a wash, but do you try to find some cap room to bring at least some veteran arm in?
Listen, I think it is I think it's incredibly unlikely that we would learn he's going to miss the full year until we are into the year. I think if he hasn't played by week 7 and they keep holding out hope, he's on the PUP list to start the season. And then, but to take the hypothetical that they'd say in training camp he's having another
shoulder surgery. Well, they didn't have to say anything yesterday, and they did make a comment.
Absolutely.
So. Well, but you have to understand, too, that the owner, this one is his first press conference. Now, he was a minority owner with the Pittsburgh Steelers, but owning the team, this is all new to him. So I think that as he owns the team, he'll get better at the press conference. Because as Nick said, he didn't have to say that. But I give him benefit of the doubt. He's new at this. And he'll learn how to, you know, massage it a little more before saying certain things like this before people were like, wow, Cam Newton might miss the whole season. I'm sure if you asked him today, he wished he could have that part of the conversation back.
But to answer your question, if Cam, let's just say, has a major setback or something to where if before the year they realize he's going to miss the season, I wonder what the Teddy Bridgewater market is going to be. And I know it's the third rail a bit, but given who this owner is and his relationship with the political climate in this country and him being the new age owner, I wonder if this would be the one team that would maybe give Colin Kaepernick a tryout. And that would say if Colin, even 2 years out of football, if he could come in and be at least compete with Taylor Heinicke. But I don't think you have a lot of options because any quarterback that's available is going to want a multi-year deal, and the Panthers are not in position to give any quarterback a multi-year deal when they have Cam Newton.
Yeah, I think you can bring up a great point as far as cap. I don't think you're just throwing it in there because if you look at it, if they do the same thing they did with Eric Reed, they were down several safeties and realized, wow, they had him on their board as a potential player. When the safeties end up getting hurt, they needed him, so they went to their board. His name was right there on the board, so they brought him in. Yeah. And the stance that he had made for the anthem, it wasn't part of the conversation and talking to the coaching staff. It was about football. And right now, if Cam has an injury, is there a guy that you, is Cam Newton-ish that has played in the league? None better than Colin Kaepernick. So if they do have the same board, if they're still getting their players the same way I know all these teams get players, then Colin Kaepernick's name will be mentioned in this offseason with Cam Newton and watching his rehab.
And the only reason I brought up the political side of it is just the owner, the new owner of the Panthers has publicly feuded with the president. And so we know that the president has had negative comments about Cap. That, I think, had maybe a chilling effect for a lot of the owners that are tight with the president. With Dave Tepper, that would almost have the reverse impact that it might for a Jerry Jones or a Bob McNair, the late Bob McNair, who had close relationships with the president.
All right, let's take a break. Coming up, talk some Cowboys. Can Jason Garrett bring a Super Bowl back to Dallas? He'd have to stay there in order to do it. That is next on First Things First. On January 26th, undefeated welterweight world champion Keith Thurman squares off against Josecito Lopez. PBC on Fox, live from Barclays Center, January 26th, only on Fox and the Fox Sports app. Time now for Say What? All right, so the Nets beat the Celtics in Brooklyn Monday night. Friends of the show Richard Jefferson and Sarah Kustak were calling the game, and RJ had a funny interaction with some Celtics fans after the game. Say what?
A lot of Boston people. Yeah, it's a lot of Boston people.
Sir, I just want to say one thing about Boston.
You love
one,
it. You love
guys
it.
You got great fans. Boston fans are some of the best in the league.
Yeah.
And two, I'm 4-0 against Boston in the playoffs.
A little.
Get that, RJ.
Right there.
Zark, when Sarah Paul's like, "Where's how's this gonna go?" RJ is becoming a media superstar now.
He's good.
And he really is.
He's charming. He's great.
The telecast, they really work well together. The Brooklyn Net, if you look at the type of talent that they have, not only on the court, the Kustak, Richard Jefferson, Ryan young broadcaster. Oh, man, they really are doing a good job.
No, it's really good.
Job.
And I like RJ. And one of the things RJ brings to the table, and you brought this up, is when you played as long as he did,
and they got the what's name? Oh man!
They have great in stadium people as well. See?
Oh yeah, the Peloton coach.
Yeah, the Peloton coach is also. Yes, that is what he's going to say.
Allie Love.
Watch the show later.
Allie Love, she's outstanding.
Time for stories to start your morning. Good news for Carson Wentz. Doug Peterson reaffirmed his commitment to Wentz moving forward. We got 3 hours. You can bring it up again. But he mentioned he would love to keep Nick Foles. So the Eagles are all in on Carson Wentz, despite the Foles' magic carpet ride. See, Eagles making the right decision here?
Of course. What other decision is there? Oh, Nick Foles is the starter?
Well.
Oh, you don't have a quarterback competition? You think they haven't had a quarterback competition? You think Carson Wentz isn't light years better than Nick Foles in practice? That's why you make a decision like this. It's easy. When you see them in practice and what they do, and yes. Now, Carson Wentz, is he the future? Yes, he is. Nick Foles, has he deserved a chance to be a starter again? Yes, but both of those things can be true.
And listen, they can't bring it cap-wise, they literally can't, but also practically speaking, you can't have Foles looking over Wentz's shoulder. If the team gets off to a slow start in that market with those fans, I know my friend Adam Lefko presented the idea of the starter closer. Carson Wentz is your starter. Nick Foles is your closer.
Of the game or the season?
The season. I don't think that's a real football
thing. Was that
thing,
a radio though? Show or something?
What?
That couldn't have been on TV.
It's on a
because people typically
show.
Get a little more sophisticated before they get the TV.
It's on the internet.
So what? Somebody's basement?
He's a star, man.
All right, to
are
the
you
NBA
sure?
now.
I'm sure.
It looks like the MVP race is down to just two names. Both Giannis and James Harden are listed at 3-2 to take home the honors. Nick, is Vegas right? It's down to just these two?
Things could change in the final 40 games of the season, obviously. But right now, these two guys should be the enormous favorites. Third is LeBron at 8-1. Fourth is Steph at 11-1. Both of those guys could be higher, but they both have missed about 11, 12 games this year, and that's why they're where they're at. It is a two-man race at this point. I'm surprised Harden wasn't a slight favorite over Giannis. Seeing them neck and neck like this, it's about where I had it. I thought Vegas would have Harden.
Yeah, I think the overall team success access and Giannis's ability to rebound the basketball. Those things are so, so special. So I think that right there, they have it right as far as Vegas. The other two players that are the third and fourth, LeBron and Steph, they had significant injuries to miss time. LeBron's still not back on the court, so they can forfeit the MVP for this season for those two.
And we'll talk more about LeBron in a second, but the Warriors reminded everyone they are the Warriors. Last night, they crushed the Denver Nuggets 142-111. KD, Steph, and Klay combined for 89 points, and the team set an NBA record with 51 first quarter points. Nick, when the team is playing like this, how big is the gap between them and the rest of the West?
Well, them and the rest of the NBA, it's what we've seen over the last 2 years. When they're playing like this, we've seen in the playoffs one team take them past five games. You cannot beat this team nights that Klay, Steph, and KD are hitting shots. They're just, when those three guys alone can account for 89 points, they're not going to be beaten. They were playing a Nuggets team that's trying to say, we're right there with you, and they ended that game in the first quarter.
Last night's game was about hope, the NBA hopes that maybe Denver or someone can give them a competitive series. We saw what happens when hope meets focus, because last night, Warriors focused like the world champion that they are, let you know that there's no hope for the rest of the NBA, and focus will always win, Jenna.
Got it. When hope floats, it's an entirely different story.
Great reference.
Completely. Finally, good and bad news for the Lakers. The bad news first. Rich Paul said LeBron is out for at least the next two games, maybe more. Good news, though, the Lakers did beat the Bulls last night 107-100. Nick, you've been on this story from the beginning. What do you make of the Lakers without LeBron?
All right, so let me just first quickly address the LeBron injury news. So I was told Friday night, but I wasn't in a place to reveal it, but now Rich Paul has revealed it publicly, that as of Friday night, it was 10 to 12 more days minimum. That they're the reevaluation that's going to be released today, throw that out the window, that it was 10 to 12 days minimum from Friday night. I've now been told, and cross off OKC and cross off Houston's Rich Paul said, probably also cross off Golden State. So that means that this is officially the most significant injury of LeBron's career, the only real injury of LeBron's career, and what that means for him moving forward, I'm sure we'll discuss at length later. For the Lakers right now, the story is this was an opportunity with LeBron out and with Rondo out.
Someone step
for
up.
For one of these young players to show, okay, I'm going to take a back seat when LeBron's out there. But when he's not, we're not going to be the Cavs of the last few years that can't win a game without him. But they basically have been. And it is really, to me, disappointing to see the stagnation from last year to this year of Lonzo Ball and Brandon Ingram. They're statistically identical players that are just slightly worse than they were last year, playing almost identical minutes. Ingram, he's down in rebounds and assists and three-point percentage. Lonzo's down in points, rebounds, and assists, slightly up in three-point percentage. The lack of growth, and by the way, add D'Angelo Russell when he was on this team, the lack of growth for him until he went to the Nets and actually blossomed a bit as a player. These are guys that were blue-chip prospects, and the only player that I've seen substantial growth from is your guy Kuzma, and given the circumstances of what I've seen from the other guys, I give Kuzma the credit for that more than I give the Lakers' infrastructure. That's the most concerning thing is, where is the pop of their young two blue-chippers?
And when you don't have development in two guys that you spent those high lottery picks on, that's when you start to get pressure on the coach, because it's one thing to win games. It's another thing to be able to develop young players. You might not like the coach in Philadelphia. You might not like his strategy. You might not like it. But the reason why he's still there is because when they were losing, those players developed. That's why you could have Ben Simmons in the highlight. That's why you can have Joel Embiid going off last night for 31. And when you don't have that, and you've seen the lack of development in Ingram, lack of development in Ball. And now I'm going to give them a little bit of a break, because this Lakers team is not put together to be absent of Rondo and absent of LeBron. Like, you need one of those playmakers in there. Now, yes, there is an opportunity. There's an opportunity for someone else to be the primary ball handler, that being either Ingram or Ball. Neither one of them have embraced that or taken over that. And also, there's an opportunity for leadership. And that's one of the things that I don't see in either one of these players. And you can be a lottery pick, but it's hard not to be an elite player, be a top five lottery pick, and not be some type of substantial type of leadership that comes from you. Like, that part right there, the coaching development and the lack of leadership and potential energy between those two players, I believe that to be a problem, and that's a Magic Johnson, Rob Pelinka problem.
Yes. I mean, can you look at this and say, well, when LeBron is in there, or to some degree Rondo, the guys don't have to do as much. They don't have to, maybe they're not spending as much time developing because there's always, well, we've got this safety net, so let's just sort of play, and at the end in the fourth quarter, he's going to save us again. Maybe that hampers or stunts their development or growth a little bit.
But so here's the thing. Like, maybe the Lakers will be fine. Like, they are still going to get playoff LeBron. They are still going to have Rondo back. They are still, if they end up on the other side of the bracket, then Golden State, I think they could win a couple rounds in the playoffs because of LeBron. But what about these players? What about the number two pick of the 2017 draft, Lonzo Ball? The number two pick of the 2016 draft, Brandon Ingram? And what those guys are supposed to be on their NBA trajectory? What about who those guys are that if LeBron after this season were to say, you know what, I just want to be a movie star. You know what, I want to move to Nepal and be a I'm done. Who are those players?
Right. And there's what excuses does it mean for those players not to develop, and not only the impact it's going to have on this season, but if you're a free agent, if you're Kawhi, you're like, I like the Clippers, Doc Rivers. Now, they got some players far more developed than the younger Lakers players. And, I'll stay in the same building. And I like the Clippers situation better because of the lack of development. So it becomes important also from a trade standpoint.
Of course.
A superstar coming there, and from a trade standpoint, you want the league to be clamoring. I want this guy. I want that guy. I want that guy. And now, right now, who they want? They want Kyle Kuzma, which should be the third guy in a trade that they should be discussing.
That's the most disappointing part of this. There was potential silver lining. Oh, LeBron's going to miss. I thought it would be 3 to 5. Chris said it would be longer than that. Now it's now going to be 10 to 13 games he ends up missing, or 11. We know at least 11. During this month of basketball, Ingram or Ball can really enhance their trade value, show they could be the centerpiece of a trade. They haven't done that. And I won't believe those guys. I can't put it all on the Lakers. I won't believe those guys are putting the work in until they're not shooting 62% and 42% respectively from the free throw line. Wow. Like, from the free throw line. Come on. Like, that it shouldn't be that hard.
All right, let's get back to football, talk some Cowboys. At the midway point of the year this season, they were 3-5, couldn't find an identity, and the jury was still out on Dak Prescott. Oh, and the head coach, Jason Garrett, well, he looked to be on the chopping block. But after finishing the season with the NFC East title and a playoff win, doesn't look like Jason Garrett is going anywhere. Just ask Jerry Jones.
When I look around at what other teams are doing and trying to do to find their head coach, if Jason Garrett had been out on the market 2 weeks ago, he would have had 5 offers for head coaching. I know that. You've got to look at what your alternative is.
So if you listen to that whole interview, Jerry Jones gave him high praise, came just short of talking extension. But if you just focus on what we have, is Garrett the right guy to take the Cowboys to the next level, CC?
Of course he is. Absolutely. Because he understands the Dallas culture. Every ownership, every owner, every team, every locker room, every franchise has a culture. And you have to try to understand that culture compared to most owners are not going to give you the Nick Saban. Oh, you can come in, create whatever you want. Blow up everything, fire everyone. They're not going to do that. It costs too much money, and no one has earned that type of trust. Unless Bill Belichick, him and the Crafts fall out, and he would decide to go anywhere. Who else? I mean, the Raiders. I hope people
John
are learning
Gruden
from that.
Did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, how did that work out so far?
Not great.
All right, I can guarantee he won't make it to the end of that contract. So being able to manage the franchise from a PR standpoint, their players are developed. We just got off the Lakers. Man, what's the problem? The younger players aren't developing. Well, Jerry Jones and Stephen Jones, that draft part, their draft room, their pro personnel, their college scouting, it has been tremendous. Man, they have gotten players, and they have developed those players. Now, they have taken some chances on some edgy guys as far as personalities. Are they going to be involved in the drug program? And they've missed on some of those guys. But they have taken a chance on guys in the draft and developing them. Jason Garrett has been a part of that. Their staff has already got overhauled. So they allowed the coaching staff to make the changes. You can see the young players are adjusting to those coaches. So, yes, I do believe that Jason Garrett is a good enough football coach from an X's and O's and all the other things, managing the game and managing the culture of that team. I think he's done a good job of that.
I think we need to remind the audience what an NFL head coach historically has been. Because in this hiring cycle, what it looks like a lot of teams are doing is they find the offensive coordinator they want, and they're like, we're just going to make you the head coach. They are hiring guys to fix their quarterback, to run their offense, and they're giving them the head coach title.
And if people want to ask, well, why would they be doing that now, just absent of Sean McVay and him being popular with the Rams? Well, if you look at the game and if you look at the rules of football, they've almost eliminated a lot of the special teams. So now the football game is not a third offense, a third defense, and a third special teams. And based on the rules, it is more of an offensive game, not just because of the rules and them throwing the ball, but teaching the game. I would much rather have an offensive coach now because I can teach the rules of the game to my defensive staff and how we're going to attack it. Everything leans to the offense. So right now, if you're an owner, I would lean towards hiring an offensive coach for those reasons.
And just look at the Final Four. It's not the four best defenses in football. It's four best offenses in football.
Easily.
The two best defenses in football won a combined zero playoff games this year. The Ravens got manhandled, and the Bears got unlucky. But they, when you play that style of football, luck plays a bigger part of it because you're playing low-scoring
games.
And
even if you look at those other teams that got eliminated, Nagy, offensive coach. Lynn, Chargers, offensive coach.
Absolutely. And so this is the way the league is going. But the reason I bring it up is Jason Garrett is a good CEO. He is good at being the head coach of the Cowboys. That is, there's a lot involved in that. Now, could, in my opinion, could he use a better COO? Could he use a more creative offensive mind to help develop the offense and develop Dak? I think he could. Now, they seem committed to Scott Linehan.
Right.
They've made that clear. But Scott Linehan's been an offensive coordinator in this league from 2009 until now, with the Lions and the Cowboys only 1 year off. There's only 2 years he's been the coordinator of a good offense, the 2011 Lions and the 2016 Cowboys. Could they use, in my opinion, some fresh blood, even if it's leaving Linehan as offensive coordinator, similar to what they did on the defense with Chris Richard, bringing in someone almost a co-defensive coordinator is what they did with
Richard. Yeah, because that Chris Richards, what he brought in, the coverage aspect to help revamp that secondary to go with Rod Marinelli and what he was doing with the defensive front as the as the full-time assigned defensive coordinator.
Chris Richard is the defensive passing game coordinator. Do I think the Cowboys could use a passing game coordinator to help the route combinations in Dak? I do, but that is not what Jason Garrett is there for. I know he was a quarterback, but he is not. He's got a lot of other things on his plate that aren't, I am going to be the quarterback whisperer that the Jets are asking Adam Gase to be, for example.
Or I'm just going to be a head coach in general. In Dallas, it's a whole different game. You have to be a conduit between Jerry Jones and what happens on the football field, which is an entirely different skill set that you need to have where other coaches maybe wouldn't be as successful. He happens to be great at that, and Jerry Jones
And he's 77 and 59. Like, there's a long list in his career coaching. It's a long list of NFL head coaches that we consider good coaches that have a winning percentage right around 56%. That's where Jason Garrett is. I do think the offense could use a little more nuance, if you will. I wonder if they'll add it this offseason.
I don't think people care that much, but I'm going to say this. Jason Garrett's a good guy, too. Beginning and end of the day, man, he's a good guy, man. And I would like to see him be successful because I like to see good people be successful at their profession.
I care about that. I'm glad he's a good guy.
Absolutely.
All right, I'm now a Jason Garrett guy.
I don't care so much.
Coming up, he doesn't care so much. Does the Patriots defense have any answer for Tyreek Hill? That's ahead on First Things First. Welcome back to First Things First. Former NFL head coach Eric Mangini is here.
Good morning.
What's the smirk for,
now,
guys?
Television diva.
Happy to be here.
Television diva. Got new threads on.
It looks good.
We're about to talk about someone who's high maintenance, so we bring in
someone who's high maintenance.
Yes. Yeah, I am.
When I think
I'm
Coach Mangini, I think high maintenance. There's a lot of talk about Antonio Brown's future after the way the Steelers season ended, you know, with him not playing in their last game because he walked out of practice there last week. Seems unlikely he will be back with the Steelers. Jerry Rice says AB wants to be with the 49ers, and now Bruce Arians, Tampa's new head coach, says he sees, quote, too much diva in the star wide receiver. A lot of takes here, Coach. What do you think the challenges that present itself in bringing a guy like AB into a locker room?
Well, the challenge is, first for the Steelers, is letting him go. When you've got a guy that is as talented as he is, the idea of giving him to another team or trading another team, it makes you sick. And you want to be able to figure out a way to make it work with the group that you have. And he makes Ben Roethlisberger better. He is an elite player, and he's created a lot of issues there. But it's really hard from a head coaching perspective or from a GM or ownership perspective to get past or to get your head around the idea of letting him go or moving on from him. Now, that being said, it's a little bit like a disruptive kid in a classroom where, from a coaching perspective, you have to spend so much time with that student mm-hmm. that you neglect a lot of other guys, and you don't get to put the time into the plan that you would want to with other people. And at what point does that become greater than the value he has on the field?
So let's, if we can, almost disregard the first piece of it. Let's just say in a hypothetical, because you always say, I forgot who told you, that if you want to be a head coach, if you want to pick the players, become a GM, if you want to pick the GM, own a team, I'm misquoting it, but you around there?
In the range.
Okay, so let's just, Art Rooney II has come out and said, it looks like he might not be on the team. If the owner says move him, doesn't matter how squeamish Kevin Colbert or Mike Tomlin are about it, they got to listen to their owner. If you are, what type of environment, what type of team do you think would be best suited to take on Antonio Brown, the good and the bad?
Well, it depends on Antonio Brown's approach when he gets to that team. Like New England has historically taken on guys that have been challenging in other environments. And because the locker room is mature, because the majority of the guys are pushing in the same direction, because there's always a chance to win the Super Bowl, a lot of time those guys will come back in line or they'll fit in with the group because they're looking down the line towards a chance to win a Super Bowl. You see what happens we've seen what happened in L.A. with the Rams, where they brought in a lot of guys that would be considered challenging. They're fine. It's fine when you're winning. Those guys become a real issue if you hit a rough patch. Mm-hmm. That's when it all implodes.
Yeah, DeSean Jackson, Tampa Bay. Mm-hmm. Now, he doesn't want to be there. When you talk about wide receivers like that, Coachman makes a good point. The winning is very, very important, and their overall productivity. Because wide receiver, they're about a couple things. Number one, they're about their numbers. Number two, they're about their money. I like the fact that you brought up New England from a culture standpoint, because I believe that New England, they made a trade for Josh Gordon, didn't they? Didn't they trade a fourth or fifth rounder for him?
Fifth rounder.
Right? Yeah. Okay, so Antonio, given the number he has, he is the type of player that New England is a perfect trade for them. Because I don't think he's going to get a one. But he has a cap number for the next 3 years, because as long as Tom Brady is there, they're going to be in a win right now mentality. So I think New England is one of the viable landing spots for him. And I believe it's probably one of the better spots because the expectations of him when he comes into the building will be totally different if he goes somewhere. Kyle Shanahan, I got a lot of respect for how he coaches, but he doesn't command the respect on day number one that Bill Belichick and players in the transition. I don't know what's in the paperwork. I don't know what it is, but somehow, no matter what city they're coming from, on their way to New England, they make a transformation. So Antonio's going to have to decide, how long do I want to be able to play this game? And he's going to have to adjust his attitude, because I'm terrified if I'm a coach bringing him in, not because of productivity. I'm terrified of what the younger players are going to see. And the younger players, if they see the behavior of an older guy who is paid and one of the league leaders and best at his position, you can believe ultimately that kid, when he gets a position in the classroom like AB has, he's going to act like AB does. So when you look at your roster, you're wondering what type of effect that receiver is going to have on your roster. So I would be careful in the places that I'm going to bring him. I also believe that Denver's a viable spot because Emmanuel Sanders is there, and I know the head coach is not having it. He's an old school coach, defensive coach, one that you like, and he's not going to have it. So I'm going to put him in a situation that it puts pressure on him to continue to change compared to accepting the behavior that we've seen in Pittsburgh.
And Chris makes a great point. It's the lessons that they teach the younger players. So if you're in a win right now mentality and you feel like you're close and you've got a mature locker room and you can incorporate a guy like that, can be a huge asset. If you've got a young locker room and you're trying to create a culture, you're trying to set things up for the long term, and you have a guy that comes in and sets a poor example that you've paid, that you've validated, you're saying organizationally, it's okay to act like this.
That's why a team that has a need that might be a fit theoretically, I don't think will be in the market for him, and that's the Jets. Because the Jets are exactly what you're talking about. They are a couple years from winning. They are trying to build a new culture around a new head coach, around their young quarterback. They do have a need at wide receiver, obviously. I know Robbie Anderson's there, but aside from him, they don't really have a true number one receiver. But you would be a team like that, you'd be worried about. Bring in Antonio Brown and what the trickle-down effect as far as on the other players. And my concern with AB is very simple. I can deal with diva. I can deal with volatile. I cannot deal with unreliable. And that's why I never would have, in a thousand years, I never thought I would be advocating for trading a player of Antonio Brown's caliber when you're as good as the Steelers until he walked out on the team. Like, you can throw as many coolers as you want, yell at the quarterback, spike the ball in practice. I know you don't like it, but I can deal with it.
No, because they all lead to something. That's why Coach doesn't like it. Like, because they all lead to something. It's like the little kid. Man, you think they start, they don't wake up throwing spitballs. No, they graduate to that. And then the next thing you know, they're doing other things,
sure,
disrupting the class. That's why Coach said, typically, if a diva wide receiver, they start off somewhere. They don't come into the league that way. All right, they start off somewhere, and it starts a lot like that. I disagree with you as far as the Jets, because if I am the Jets, and I'm trying to not be the stepbrother here in New York, I'm trying not to be the stepbrother to New England and what they do in the AFC East, I bring in a player like him because I know the head coach and the young quarterback, it's going to make both of them instantly better. I like his cap number, and it's going to bring you more optics on your team. It gets you off of Broadway and to potentially put you on Broadway. So I think the Jets are a viable spot because he needs big productivity, you know. And if I told you, that's one of the reasons I'll be able to solve his problem, because I'll get him the football. And if you get him the football, you're going to have less problems.
What does it say about a guy like Bruce Arians, who knows Antonio Brown very well, knows his work ethic, knows his productivity, doesn't want him and needs him, would be willing to pass on a guy with that talent?
Did he say he'd be willing to pass? He just said there was too much diva.
The assumption is.
I actually see that as a more viable place than New York, because there is a relationship. And if you can bring him in and say, hey, I know you, AB. We were together for a long time. I know what your potential is. This is what my expectations are here in Tampa. And you get that understanding as a head coach. The thing with Adam Gase is he had some guys that were considered divas down in Miami.
Yes.
And then he shipped them all out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard for me to think that he might be willing to bring him in. But in Tampa, if you've had a pre-existing relationship and you knew a guy before he came up, before he really made it, sometimes you can have that connection of, I'm going to help you achieve your goals. You help me achieve mine.
And I think Bruce said that in the follow-up. He said he's a different guy now than the guy that we drafted in Pittsburgh. And you're right about that intel. Typically, if I knew you before the stardom hit, you have an avenue to be able to get in there for them to have an ear to be able to hear you.
Yeah, and they'll be open sometimes to the coaching, because you've given them that coaching before when they were a young guy. You've had that honesty that sometimes it's hard to have with someone you don't know, and now you're a star.
What is it with your positions? Why do you guys have to be so diva and jerky all the time?
Diva and jerky.
Not you, of course.
Wow.
Maybe there was a cup of coffee where you were, but not anymore.
Wow.
Okay. When you watch the games this weekend, watch how many times they send 10 guys out there. Watch how many times. I've seen the show without me on it. Okay. Hey, be careful what you ask for.
Coach, stick
all right,
around.
I might
take a break.
I'll leave with Coach Mangini.
Coming up.
Then what will you have?
Is the Rams offense?
Oh, all of a sudden that diva stuff ain't
We're back
so
after this. Back here with Coach Mangini. Let's take a look at the NFC title game on Sunday. Saints and Rams. Rams had a dominant 1-2 punch in their ground game Saturday against the Cowboys. Both C.J. Anderson and Todd Gurley had over 100 yards as the Rams set a franchise postseason record with 273 rushing yards. Nick, you had Saints defensive end Cam Jordan on your radio show yesterday. You asked him the key to shutting down this Rams offense.
Make them one-dimensional. I mean, for most teams, it's taking that pass away. But, you watch how Todd Gurley runs, and now you watch how effective CJ has been the last couple of games. We have to try and tighten down on the run game, make them one-dimensional.
All right, Coach, what do you think? What do you think the game plan should be for the Saints defense, and what should they expect, rather, from the Rams on Sunday?
I think the Rams need to continue along the lines that they had last week and run the ball and run the ball even if it's not as effective as they hope it is early. You look at the last game, what Saints put up, 35 points in the first half? So while running the ball, you're going to shorten the game. That's a positive. By running the ball, you're going to slow down their pass rushers. It's going to open up the play action. They were effective running the ball last game. To me, that's the starting point, but you've got to have the patience to stick with it. And it's hard against New Orleans because if they do get up 7 or 14, you think that you're chasing. And there's that tendency to, okay, we've got to get points quickly. We've got to change our approach. And to me, that's where teams get in trouble against New Orleans because it opens up for the pressure packages. It does turn them into one-dimensional teams. I'd say the other thing is protecting the football. You saw the play at the end of the first half where they throw an interception. I think it was about a minute and 30 seconds left. The Saints
were talking in their first matchup.
Their first game.
Rams throw a pick late.
That mistake was huge. And it's a 10-point game. It's just so hard to overcome errors like that where you're pressing again to make a play and suddenly you put yourself in a horrible situation.
And I know the Saints all year long have been a great rush defense. They finished the year number 2 against the run, and that's in total yards, but also top 5 in yards per rush allowed. So it's not just that teams were abandoning the run. It's one of the reasons teams were abandoning the run is because they couldn't successfully run. But a big part of that was Sheldon Rankins.
Yep.
And he's out. Sheldon Rankins is the D tackle, I think their best run defender on that team. Mm-hmm. That is the substantial injury they suffered in the last round of the playoffs. Cam Jordan, who was talking there, is an excellent pass rusher and I think a good run defender, but he's not, you don't look at him as his strength is one of those, he's not a 3-4 D end who's taking, no, he's a 4-3 defensive end pass rusher. And so if you are going to have success on the Saints running the football, this would be the week. And you've got not only Todd Gurley, but now CJ, who has played 3 games for the Saints, 422 yards in those 3 games. He's been over a buck 20 in week 16, week 17, and in the playoff game. So you have a legitimate dual threat run option, and it is a pounding run option with that I would imagine would take a toll on a defense just stylistically with the body that CJ Anderson has and with the power and speed Todd Gurley has.
Yeah, one thing too with the Rams that they have. Coaches always talked about continuity in organization, continuity in the coaching staff. But they have tremendous continuity, one-of-a-kind continuity on the offensive line. This year, only offensive line coaches started all 16 games. Last year, only offensive line that started every game.
That's
they have
crazy.
All their senior players on the left-hand side.
Whitworth
and Scaffold, the left guard. They got a tremendous experience there. So them going against the Saints, it should be an advantage. When you go into a dome, I played most of my career in a dome, and one of the things that we knew how teams would try to attack us, and one thing early is it's harder to be able to throw the ball in a dome on third down. So if you want to throw it, you better throw it on first or second down. So what I would do, based on all that running and CJ and Todd Gurley last week, I would come out, play action passing the Saints, and I'm throwing the ball at the weakest part of their secondary. And when you play action, it's the best pass protection. So you can pretty much sustain a maximum rush from the defense. It's the best pass protection, and that quarterback, I want him to get comfortable in the dome. What happened in the earlier season meeting, the Saints got off to an amazing red-hot start, and the Rams were chasing. They were in a panic mode. So for me, I understand running the ball. I understand eating up the clock. I understand time of possession. But play-action pass is the best way to make a dent in the enthusiasm in that building and get your quarterback, get him feeling good early.
And what's great for the Rams is they've experienced the noise in there.
That does help.
They've gotten over that that first time, and they have a much better understanding of how they need to communicate, how they need to make adjustments, how they need to audible now as opposed to the first time they went in there. And the continuity in the offensive line is huge, and you can put so much of your trust into that group because they've worked together so well and for so long. And I do agree with Chris, too. It's not like their secondary has been impressive. They've struggled throughout the course of the year. So if you can attack them effectively which most people have been able to, it's a great approach.
And this is where the offense in the league that's gotten the most headlines is the high-scoring offense, the Chiefs. But if not for the Chiefs, the Rams would be the number one offense across the board. I mean, they're second in points, second in yards, third in rushing, fifth in passing. Everything they're second in, it's to Kansas City. This Rams offense, I know that in the playoff game it was all running. Jared Goff was basically a caretaker. They have been a prolific offense in every way, shape, and form. And a huge part of that has been the play-action pass game because people are afraid of Todd Gurley. They ran play-action on more than 50% of their pass attempts in the first playoff game. I think that's a huge part of this weekend.
And people say, oh, he's a wide receiver. He wants to throw the ball. I really believe that's the best way to attack. And also, you have to realize when you're playing in that type of environment, we'll talk about the weather in Kansas City, but I don't think people are going to mention playing in a dome. When you play in an NFC Championship, those domes get hotter. How do I know that? I've played in a couple of them, and I played in a dome throughout my career. So watch the fatigue factor. You talked about Sheldon Rankin. What about that rotation of the Saints? They're down one of their primary defensive linemen. So that rotation, I'm throwing the ball early, but I'm pounding it later on. It's going to be hot in that building. I was in the Superdome when the Saints played the Vikings the last time they matched up in the NFC Championship. The humidity in that game, Brett Favre game, where he threw the interception, yep. Patty Mahomes style going across of his body. So there can be a fatigue factor playing in a dome. Late in the season, you're down in numbers. We know Sheldon Rankin is going to be missed. So how do they, what does Dennis Allen do, the defensive coordinator, to put that extra guy into the rotation? And the impact, I believe, fatigue-wise, can be to the Rams' advantage if they come out and hit some of those passes early. And
I've got a fatigue factor.
It was interesting, too, to hear some of the defensive linemen talk about Sheldon Rankin's effect from a communication standpoint, how he helped those guys in terms of shifting the defensive line back and forth and eating up the offensive linemen, taking it off the linebackers. That part's going to be big as well.
Quickly, something you said earlier, it's hard to throw on third down in a dome. Why is that?
Because it's so loud. That's when the crowd
is going
to be the loudest.
Even if a team has been there already knows.
The fans are going to be loud throughout, but they are going to be at their absolute
loudest. This will be the loudest the Saints fans have ever been. What time the game start?
What? 3:30?
My man Brumley said they'll be liquored up, too.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.